thanks again for giving me the opportunity to talk about some of my work here and some of my ideas on the questions that have been put forth to us. So I'm going to give you some insights, my insights into these following areas, definition of the field, and what I do, which is mainly dynamics of sensory coding, and I'll talk about some specific examples, saccades, again, I guess we just heard about some of this, stimulus-driven network oscillations, noise, and multi-scale signal separation. And then I'll address the other points on research highlights in the field, critical considerations for those entering, training, and suggested changes. And there will be none of this today, no talk of fish, but tomorrow at the CNS you'll hear more about some of this work as well. So computational mathematical neuroscience, so an obvious definition of the field, is the intersection of those computational sciences and mathematics with neuroscience. And the key word here is, what do you mean by intersection? And I have a fairly broad view of this, mainly because I work at many different ends of this spectrum, but for me the intersection implies any percentage of overlap and relevance from 0.0 something to 99 point something. So, you know, from one extreme can be all math or all neuro, and also you have varying degrees of experimental theoretical interaction. They're all part of this big computational neuroscience picture, as far as I see. I call my own field neurophysics and nonlinear dynamics, and maybe that's just because, you know, I'm in a physics department, but there's lots of commonalities with what my applied math colleagues do. So I study cellular biophysics, and I model electric fields, and nonlinear dynamics is an important mathematical tool for what I do, and also I throw noise into a lot of the problems that I study because the noise is there, and I'll show you some examples. So I need to do Langevin equations and Fokker-Planck equations, and figuring out how these processes interacting noise with dynamics produce new kinds of effects that would not exist otherwise. This is called non-equilibrium stat-mech in the physics literature, and also some information theory, and of course you have to do lots of computational theory, computational physics, computational mathematics. And the specific neuroscience fields of interest, to me anyways, is sensory acquisition and processing. And I'm particularly interested in these problems, what does feedback do, those delays do, noise do, and how they impact memory in the system. And also I'm interested in sensory motor integration, such as posture control, timing, movement of eyes. And all these things lead to very interesting problems in bifurcation theory and non-equilibrium stat-mech. And these problems really arise from the neuroscience interests. You work on the neuroscience problem and you find that, well, you know, I don't know this theory. I need this theory. And you look it up. Oh, it's not there. And you have to go and try and do some of it yourself. And I would say there's many approaches out there. So there are those who specialize in a few, maybe one or a couple analytical tools. And they look for the right nuts, you know, to put the nutcracker on. So, you know, I always solve this thing and I want to crack those kinds of nuts. And you have the other kind of people who specialize on, you know, one neurobiological system. And they study it in great detail. So you study it well enough using a variety of tools. And those tools come from, you know, many different nutcrackers. Because you're getting at the principles of neural design. And I compare this approach to that of an old professor I had in physics, University of Montreal, Gilles Fontaine, who studied the evolution of one class of stars, so these brown dwarf stars. And he studied them for all his life and knows them in great detail, all their sequence, how they're born, how they die, and so on. And this is only one of such set of many kinds of stars. But in the end, he knows it so well that he can just predict the age of the universe very exactly. Well, as exactly as we'll ever know. But it's a standard, you know, in the field. So you can kind of get at those, by studying one system in great detail, you can get at some very important principles. And of course, we haven't been the first ones to do this kind of computational neuroscience. People have been doing this for a long while. This is the Arab philosopher Avicenna was doing this, you know, back in the 1300s. These are you know, black box models of brain function, and you have the different ventricles here for common sense and imagination, and we just have other words for this these days, for the different parts of the brain to do. Da Vinci was inspired by this as well, and this was his drawings, but some lots of similarities. So this was the earlier computational neuroscience, I would say. And I draw some particular inspiration from this person, Helmholtz, and he was very interested in, in a huge variety of things, but in particular, how you can be looking at one spot but paying attention to another spot. And this is a very high-level functioning, high-level brain cognitive process, but you can actually do some modeling on what goes on in there to see, you know, what are the neural structures that enable that. So I would say he's a neurophysics computational neuroscience pioneer. So apart from his pastimes like proving the first law of thermodynamics, you know, he was doing auditory perception and visual perception. He was the first one to measure the speed of propagation of the action potential. And to this day, this is still a pretty good number. He raised this huge debate about, you know, if there's a finite speed, then there's a delay in everything you do. So then there's a delay between your will to do something and your action to do something. And this was totally heretical at the time. So anyways, that got solved about 80 years later, but these delays are there to stay. And I got into this particular area through a sabbatical with two groups in Germany, and one of them got me interested in this problem based on Helmholtz findings, and they're now the Helmholtz Institute at the University of Potsdam. And so you look at a word and you have different levels of blur. So you have high accuracy in the middle, and the blur is as you go out. And but of course, you can read the word difficulty here, even if you're looking at this, right? So you have some perifoveal processing going on. So what we were interested a few years ago was to come up with models that eliminate the numbers of boxes in these huge multi-box models that were around, with arrows everywhere, and how you move your eyes, for example, on text when you're reading. So you can think of it as here's your brain, and you're feeding in words, and your eyes do things on them, and then you understand a sentence. So it's high-level cognitive processing, and what we decided to do is to kind of distribute the attention across the words, mostly in the forward direction. So you can have an attention window which spans from the current word to the previous word to a few words down the line. So there's this eccentricity function, which is your parallel processing of words. And we're trying to understand some basic numbers, which I'll show you in a second. There's some statistics you can measure on how your eyes move. Yes? In space, thank you, yeah. In space. So time would be another one, but we built in time through how all the words are processed one by one. You start recognizing it, and then once the word is processed, it goes away, and you're done with that word. So all the words come in and are these individual dynamical modules that go up and down in time. So then you have to decide, how do you make saccadon words? So you have all the words that are evolving in time. So these are the activities of the different words, and this is the position of your eyes, K of T. So that happens over time. And then you have these different programs that decide, you know, when you should move your eyes. And there's parts that are labile and parts that are non-labile, meaning you can cancel them or not. And then there's still a debate in the literature as to, you know, where you're going to saccade can occur in parallel with when you're going to saccade. Meaning when you're going to saccade, you need to know where you're going. So these are time and space variables. And so this takes about 80 milliseconds to, you know, to get the target selection going. And then there's the saccade execution, which takes about 20, 40 milliseconds. And you can put this stuff into a simple computational model for this, and these are the kinds of things you get. Here's a word sequence. The child had a nightmare about being chased by hornets and wasps. And people measure this on numbers of subjects. And they're measuring it in all kinds of languages and dyslexics and so on, and just trying to figure out what might be going on in various pathologies. So this is where you are on the first word at time zero, and then you jump up to the next word, and then you jump up to this word. But you see you skipped two words here. The black line just went up past the word had a, because these are very predictable. And then you keep going up. Oh, this, you have to come back and look at this one, and then you move up So the interesting thing for me was that you actually look at practically every word, even though you think you're jumping or reading words in blocks, but your eyes are actually looking at practically every single one. And these are all the activities of the words as you go along. And those activities determine where you actually saccade to. It's kind of a saliency map, and you have a target that's based on these activities of the words being processed. Yeah? This is, yeah, you can just, you have these eye trackers and you know where you're looking. Colored lines are computational models. We wish we could measure those. Yeah, but we can't. They're in the brain. What is? So as you start looking at the word the gets processed very quickly. Then you look at the word child, which starts getting processed in parallel with the word the, because you're still looking here, but you start processing the word next to it. And then you move over to that word. By the time you've moved over to that word, you've already processed a lot of it, because you have parafoveal vision, and your attention is being spread across the words. So I can't go into much detail, but this is an attempt at high-level modeling when we don't actually have the electrophysiology of the different word representations and so on, but just see how far we can get. And this model can predict things such as, you know, what's the fixation duration of your eyes as a function of the difficulty of the words. This is how people do this in the field, this 5-word difficulty classes. And you can look at single gaze fixation, first time you look at it, if you look at it only one time and so on, and you have the lines for the data and the model that line up with very few parameters to tune. Or you can look at probabilities of making saccades. And this is a model we published as the Swift model. And now what? Now you have a model that can actually predict how your eyes are going to move over sentences. But it's at some point you want to bridge back to the lower level. This is high level. So there's linking high level and low level without noise. It turns out you need noise in this model, because all these times to saccade and so on all have distributions to them. And if you don't put the noise in the model, you get these very clumsy patterns of reading, and you always do the same thing. But in reality, we don't always do the same thing. We do it in a variety of ways. So you have to incorporate the noise into the model. Without the noise, there's just a few trajectories. And there's probably some optimal noise tuning just to properly sample the input space, which are these sentences. So this is the one question: where does the noise come from, and how do you fit it in? And how does saccade selection really work? So there are people like Doug Crawford and others who are interested in this, and you want to maybe bring in these biophysical models back into this high-level model to bridge the two levels of the hierarchy. So noise is known to be an important determinant of selection in biophysical models of working memory, for example. Zhao Jing's, Wang's lab works on this. And in particular, I've teamed up with Martin Paré at Queen's, just to look at some of these issues of noise in the superior colliculus. How do you fit it into this framework? And in the end, we're interested in these more clinical questions. Can we predict neural correlates of, e.g., dyslexia and other things? What does it look like in the pattern, and can you make any sense of it? What goes wrong in that sequence or in that model when you're dyslexic? So that was one level of modeling, and it really arose from an interaction with an experimental group. And this is another thing that you may want to do as a theoretical consideration for entering the field. There's these experimental theoretical collaborations that may be of interest to you. And if you want to do that, well, you should realize they take a long while. It should be the word long here. They take a long while to develop. And the reason for that is you have to learn the language of the other. And not only that, you have to learn the folklore of a given subfield, all the unstated beliefs and so on. And that's highly non-trivial, and it takes a long while to get there. And the personalities have to click. If you can't have fun doing this, then you might as well go and do something else. And after a number of years, it's pretty interesting because you start thinking alike, and for good or for worse, I've found that with this is Len Mailer, my colleague at the University of Ottawa that I've worked for the last 10 years with. And I worked with another experimentalist when I was doing my PhD in physics at McGill. I had an experimental advisor at the Montreal Neurological Institute, John Milton, and we worked for about 7 years together, and then we stopped working together, and then we talked about 3 years later, and we were writing the same paper. And we say, well, how come you picked that topic? Well, how come you picked that topic? Well, yeah, because we've been thinking the same thing for the last few years. So you get into these pretty funny situations where maybe you need to diversify, you know. Okay, another thing is getting at what's going on in the cell. So there's different approaches, like Doug just presented. You can have like some kind of stimulus coming into a neuron, and then you have a black box for your neuron, and some spikes come out. And you can relate the output to the input via coherence functions or mutual information rates. You can do some information theory on this. We're particularly interested in turning this into a white box. Just open it up, and what's going on? And inside, you want to figure out, how does the voltage change? And the voltage, well, there's an RC circuit component, and there's maybe noise thrown in there, and there's maybe an input, and there's maybe feedback from higher order parts of the brain to come back to this place and so on. And you might want to put this in there and see if you can understand how stimulus goes to spike train. So you go from a black box to biophysical detail. And this is probably the best we can do in terms of calling the first principles, But I think it depends a lot on what question you're asking. And as you pursue these different questions in neuroscience, as I said, there's some interesting theory that comes along the way. So this is particular one that I'm interested in. Feedback. What's feedback for? Feedback is this problem here. Here's a physical stimulus. Here's a receptor like your eye. Goes to this place in your brain. Goes to this other place and this other place. This arrow's going one way. This arrow's coming back the other way. Why are they coming back the other way? And why is the brain highly interconnected like that? Right, but you can always find things that come back to where you sent them. And in particular, we're interested in the origin of gamma oscillations. And this is an example of, if you look at these kinds of systems, there's often delays, like 20 milliseconds to go from here to here and back. Okay, and this sets up oscillations in the brain. There's some instability depending on the polarity of the feedback, especially if it's negative feedback. This whole system can start to oscillate. However, there's noisy neurons and there's delays, and there's no theory that tells you how to do stochastic delay equations. So you have to cook up some new theory. And this is one such theory, Fokker-Planck analysis on noisy, leaky, integrating fire neurons. And basically, you can predict this kind of single-cell recording characteristic. You record for one cell that you think is involved in this network oscillation, and you record the power spectrum, and you calculate the power spectrum of that cell under two conditions. So this is power versus frequency. And here there's obviously in the blue line, the stimulus is such that there's no particular feature. There's broadband power, which means the cell is basically pretty noisy, but doing not much that we can tell. And under another stimulus condition, you get a nice peak, and this is in the gamma range, 40 hertz. So you have a theory now that has the biophysical detail in it, like this, and you can go and ask the question, well, what happens if I change this, or what happens if I change that, or that, or that? And you can see the detail now of these network oscillations. What are they due to? Where do they come from? Here's another problem. The theory end, totally, the previous one was inspired by data and modeled some of our data. This is something that just came out, a work done by Axel Hooten in my group. And these are neural field models. So it's a different kind of model altogether. They're spatial temporal models, and there's a coupling kernel and another coupling kernel, and you have an excitatory population and an inhibitory population, and these are the firing rate functions, and there's delays, and the delays depend on the distance between the two neurons divided by the velocity. And then there's some input, which we make as a global spatial input in the problem. And this can be a noise, and it turns out that these systems, it's easy to get them to bifurcate and to start oscillating, but they oscillate just in space, so in time, starting from somewhere down here, it goes up, and this is space, and you have a neuron that fires next to one that doesn't fire, fired, no fire, no fire, so you have a Turing pattern set up in space. And we were interested in the relevance of this in real neurophysiology when you actually have lots of noise around. So how does this pattern survive with cellular noise? And it turns out that the noise wipes it out. Now that might not be too surprising for you, but if you look at some of the theory in this field, if you just put additive noise on systems, often nothing much happens. You still get the instabilities. But in these kinds of systems, it actually puts the bifurcation at a higher value. You need more nonlinearity to start getting the system to oscillate in space. So this is a... Sorry? That parameter is way buried in there, but it's the parameter that drags you across the bifurcation. It can be the steepness of the firing function, for example. But there's a number of them that'll get it to you. Why study noise? Well, you can present one stimulus in the blue line here and record from a cell, and every time you record it, you get a different answer. You get some statistical properties that are right, but the individual realizations are different. That's why we're thinking about noise in general. And I should make you aware that if you think you're doing something novel in your field, doing computational neuroscience with noise, you're missing part of the picture, because there's people doing that next door in genetic networks, in metabolic networks, and so on. And this is a special issue that Peter Swain and I wrote, edited for Chaos, where we try to bring those two literatures together, the noisy gene people and the noisy neuron people, because they talk the same language, they use the same concepts, feed forward, feedback, and noise has all kinds of strange effects in both kinds of systems, but you may want to go and read the other side before you get onto your problem. Okay. So here's a few, an example of So where can this go in terms of being useful? So you can have hearing implants, for example. If your cochlea is damaged, you need to bypass it by stimulating the acoustic nerve. This is a feed-forward strategy. The problem is this is poor at noisy cocktail parties. So you want to get, you want to get beyond this problem. But what happens if you damage a deeper structure? Then you need to not only know the feed forward, but you need to know the feedback that comes from higher brain to that place. So you need to really figure out feed forward and feedback. And this is one of our motivations, one of our strong motivations for our work is, deeper brain structures have things going in and out and coming back at them. And you need to know those two things. So we need to figure out how the brain does, for example, blind source separation online. That's to survive at cocktail parties. And how do we do that? Well, we look at how electric fish do it, electric communication, and look at how frogs do it in swamps, because they send calls to each other all the time. Whoops, how did that get in there? There's not supposed to be any fish. Okay, you'll hear about that tomorrow. Here's what frogs... So fish hang around in groups, and they talk to each other, and they're able to do it. But we can access their electrophysiology, and try and figure out how they do it. Here's an example from Gary Rose, where you have... frogs calling each other, these are the different calls, and you have neurons here that fire only when there's a certain number of calls that come in. So the neuron that fires only with 6 calls coming in for that frog, another neuron fires with only 9 calls coming in. So there's neurons that are tuned for a number code in there. Here's a wild one. Here's 8 calls coming, 9 calls coming in and the neuron fires. Here's 8 calls and then you give a pause and give another 8 calls, and there's no response. 8 calls, give a pause, give 9 calls, and you get the response. Okay, so they're doing fancy stuff that Bell Mobility might want to know about. Okay, and this is of interest to mathematicians. There's a whole field developing around this called numerical cognition. There's various articles coming out on, how we represent numbers in our brain, so a magnitude code, and how primates can estimate numbers of objects and so on. So this is a very interesting field that I'm getting into with my colleague Gary Rose and Wolfram Gerstner in Switzerland. Okay, so briefly, research highlights, this is too many at too many levels, so I'm not going to get into it. But one thing's for sure is that there's models that have been made, they've really made their mark from the early days of cybernetics, which is today biological cybernetics, to now into Neuron and Nature Neuroscience, these journals are often, you know, begging for model descriptions of the data that go along with it. So the field has come a long way. Now, this is a bit of a pessimistic statement, and it's not totally true, but there's still some real tests to come, I would say, where you have some strong predictions with strong medical impact. But I think we're on the real right track. And there's a number of things that are out there that have really inspired clinicians already to get at some other way of thinking about the problem. So the computational neuroscience is feeding into the medical community. For those entering the field, the main question I ask is, what do you like to do? Do you want to become a hybrid? You know, do experiments and theory? Do you want to talk actively with neuroscientists? Maybe not. Maybe you want to do a theory computation and with some relevance to neuroscience. Maybe you want to just devise interesting theory. And there's no judgment. This is all good, and it's all needed. You need people working at all these levels. And the ideal training, well, again, what do you like? And do your training accordingly. Here are two examples, people in my lab. So Maurice Chacron and Brent Doireau, they both did their PhD in theoretical physics. They were also collaborating with Len Mailer, my colleague in medicine. So Mo went and did, he wanted to do experiments. So he did the Woods Hole course in systems neuroscience. And then he did an experimental postdoc, totally experimental. And now he's prof physiology at McGill and doing theory and modeling. So he's a hybrid. Brent, probably want to stay away from what Mo does. He wanted to continue in that field. He just wanted to do theory all along. So he does. He did a postdoc with a theoretical and an experimental advisor, both. So now he's just starting up, a colleague of John Rubin now at Pittsburgh. So the training really relies on a number of things, such as summer school, and we have a new one sponsored by MITACS, and it just happened 2 weeks ago, and it was a lot of fun, and it's going to keep going. And there's a few of them around the world, and now we have one around here. Workshops and work placements in other groups in Canada and abroad, multidisciplinary graduate programs. These are very important, where you can allow the flexibility to in your course selection, not just take six math courses or six quantum mechanics courses, but just, you know, get on with real life. All right. And suggested changes, just a brief overview here. I think the Canadian funding structure is pretty archaic to accommodate this new field. There's close to nothing from CIHR. Unless you collaborate with an experimentalist, you're not going to get money to do this kind of work. And hopefully that's going to change. And I see Dennis Glansman here. They have had a very successful program in the States for over, 15 years now? The Theoretical Computational Mathematical Neuroscience Program, part of NIH, our equivalent of CIHR. So we got to get going here and get something. NSERC has a few committees that are relevant to this field, the Interdisciplinary Committee, the Animal Biology, Math, and Psychology, but they all feel worried whenever they apply to one of these places. You know, what's going to happen? I'm going to be really the odd person out. And generally, we just need more exposure for our undergrads in math and physics and engineering, so we need modeling courses in the curriculum, really to get them hooked and send them to summer schools. And this national linking, which has begun through the efforts partially of Chris Eliasmith at Waterloo, just to get people talking and exchanging students and so on, and that's very important. And I should just end with this advertisement for a workshop that John Rubin and I and Steve Coombs are organizing in mathematical neuroscience at the Centre de Recherche Mathématique in September. So please come over as students and postdocs and learn more about the field. So thanks for your attention.